land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. Happy Shabbat to one and all. My wife and Dee decided about 3 weeks ago that they would make an evening question and answer with Yada. We have come upon that evening. We actually don't have Kirk, so we hope everything is right in the People's Republic of California. I understand they're being inundated now with more weather. But yes. We do have Dee with us, and Dee, we'll go ahead and start with questions. But I did want to speak to one item in the news, because I think it is really significant. And that is, today it was announced that the Chinese government, Z in particular, brokered a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia to reestablish diplomatic relations and to reestablish ambassadors and embassies, to normalize relations again. I mean, that's a stunner, folks.
That is stunning.
And it is so contrary to the narrative in Israel, which was that the only reason the Abraham Accords went forward was because Saudi Arabia gave its blessing for them, because it is the 800-pound gorilla in that world. And that Netanyahu was bragging that he anticipated normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia, in particular to create a wall in the Muslim world against, particularly with Iran on the cusp of having a nuclear bomb. And so it is absolutely devastating news. It's devastating for a number of reasons, two of which we have talked about on this program for a very long time. One of those is that that BRIC, which stands for Brazil, Russia, India, and China, are brokering a new world economic order that will not be based upon U.S. currency being the international reserve currency. And we've talked about what happens when Saudi Arabia in particular, or any OPEC nation of consequence like Iran, begins to trade oil for currencies other than the dollar, and that the Russians and the Chinese and India and other nations are able to use their currencies to buy and sell on the international market. Only reason that the United States has been able to get by with quantitative easing, which is creating the illusion of solvency, and has been able to run up a deficit that is in the $30 trillion, the most recent budget was over $7 trillion. And I remember doing a show when it was $1 trillion, and now it is over $7 trillion. And the realization is the United States is bankrupt. And yeah. The only reason we're even viable at the moment is because of the illusion of solvency. But that illusion of solvency will dissipate in a heartbeat the moment that petrodollars no longer are the source of international trade.
Right.
So that's where we are, and it is something that will have instantaneous and devastating consequences on the United States and the Western economies. The second thing is we've been talking for a long time about how the United States has effectively ostracized much of the world, trying to control everybody, pretending that it is the world is our sandbox to play in, and that we can decide who is sanctioned and who we send weapons against and who we allow into our sandbox. The United States has really ostracized right. the world with Russia and China on one side and also the Shias, but it's been Europe, the United States, and Sunni Muslims, particularly Saudi Arabia, on the other.
Yeah.
If the United States loses control of Saudi Arabia, that balance swings massively in favor of China and Russia and Iran and the other nations that would be part of BRIC. It turns the United States from the largest influencer in the world to a nation with a military they won't even have a use for. We've been talking about that for some time as the world prepares itself for a world war. It is also devastating for Israel because the most likely first strike until the United States pushed Russia into the point that she had no chance, no choice but to invade
Ukraine.
Into Ukraine, and that we literally gave Russia that is the only option for her security was to invade the Ukraine. And we've been working on that since 2008 under the Bush administration and have doubled down during the Obama administration and doubled down again with the Republicans going to Ukraine. This would be John McCain and Lindsey Graham, the two highest-ranking Republicans, back 6 years ago, declaring war on Russia with Ukraine being a proxy. And while it is likely that that mess that we have created will devolve into a nuclear confrontation, when Iran gets a bomb, you can be assured that mutually assured destruction will mean nothing to them. They are mad. And they will deploy a bomb if they have the ability to use one. And it will start world war. Netanyahu's in Italy today, and he told a reporting agency that if this is not stopped, it's going to be a nuclear war is what it's going to lead to. And the only quibble I would have with him is he's yabbered way too long. Israel is either going to do something about it, and now it's in a very difficult place because it cannot rely on Saudi Arabia. I think it was the other day that Azerbaijan also bailed, and that's a big deal because Israel needs its bases to refuel, and Israel had bought their loyalty by sending massive amounts of armaments and allowing their planes to pick up those armaments in Israel and their war against Armenia. So that's where we find ourselves. It is a devastating blow to the United States that has lost control of the situation. And the Biden administration is so comatose that they actually praised the deal and said, oh, this is a step forward for the world now. This is shaking in the boots time.
Oh, my gosh.
We are really in a terrible spot. All right, so that's the news. Sorry to bring such bad news to you, but that is the reality of what this means. And And even the talking heads, the pundits in Israel, know it. Israel is highly divided at the moment. The left is having conniption fits over judicial reform. We should probably talk about that for a moment, too.
Okay.
The Supreme Court in Israel is being viewed as if it were the Supreme Court in the United States, but nothing can be further from the truth. The Supreme Court in the United States has all of the justices appointed by and approved by elected officials. That is not the case in Israel, that a court appoints its own. So they have absolutely no democratic influence over them at all. And they have become insanely liberal. In the United States, the Supreme Court has a single mandate, and they can rule on a single mandate exclusively. They can rule whether or not a bit of legislation or a court decision was or was not constitutional. Does it comply with the U.S. Constitution, or is it counter to the U.S. Constitution? That's it. Nothing else. They can't make a ruling because, well, they don't like a law that was written because their politics differ from it. Like when they ruled on Roe v. Wade, it was on constitutional grounds only. It's not a federal right. And it's always been obvious that Roe v. Wade overstepped constitutional bounds. It is not a constitutional issue. And so no matter what you think about it, that isn't the way to go about solving the problem.
Right.
So the problem in Israel is they don't have a constitution. Most people don't know that. There is no constitution in Israel. So the court, about a decade or so ago, took it upon itself to begin to make rulings on the laws that were being passed in the Knesset, so that this unelected group appointed themselves the deciders as to whether or not the laws of the elected group could stand, not on the basis of a constitution, because there was none. So Israel needs a constitution. B, they need to get rid of the stupid parliamentary system. And, of course, they have the parliamentary system for the same reason the Star of David is their national symbol. They were harassed throughout the ages in Europe, and particularly Europe during the Second World War, by being forced to wear that six-pointed star to differentiate them for harassment. So they took that star upon themselves and said, that'll be our national symbol. It has nothing to do with David, nothing. And it doesn't even have a long history within Israel. In fact, it would be counter to the things that Yahweh has said through his prophets. But they took the symbol of shame and they wore it like a badge of honor. If you look at the parliamentary system in Israel, it is the worst government system ever devised. I think I'd rather have a Soviet-style government than I would have that. It is a government that exists by bribe. You have to form coalitions, and the way that you form coalitions is you promise people that don't get enough votes to matter other than to form the coalition all manner of things. Like Rahm was promised some $6 billion worth of support for the Muslim minority in Israel to vote for the last government. The enemy of Israel was awarded prizes to vote for that government. And then you have now this coalition from hell that is right-wing crazies forming with right-wing conservatives, forming with religious crazies. And they've got some absolute wacko people in that government, all of which were made, given promises to side with this coalition. It is a horrible form of government. And Israel has it because when they became a nation, it was carved out of the British mandate. And the British, of course, who abused them, who lied to them, who did everything imaginable harmful to them, including promoting the name Fakestinia. They had the parliamentary system, and we're going to wear that as a badge of honor. Those people that whose politics was so horrid and disruptive to us, we're going to wear that as our badge of honor. It was just flat-out stupid. But they don't have a constitution. They have a parliamentary system, and therefore they need judicial reform. And to say that judicial reform is undemocratic is to have your head in the mud, which most progressives do. Unbelievably stupid. Now, I'm not going to say for a moment that Netanyahu's motivations are benevolent. They aren't. He's been attacked by the Supreme Court for impropriety, so he despises the court system there. He used to support it. Now he despises it, and he has members of his coalition, particularly Derry, that have been twice convicted, and he wants them reinstated, doesn't want the courts to be able to override what he wants to do. So there you are, and they're splitting Israel in half at the time that the world's falling apart around them. This is a very bad thing. So why don't we start, were the one that collected these questions. Why don't you start, we'll do our best to answer some of them.
All right. The first question we have is from Russ, and he wanted to know if Yahweh actually brought anyone back to life after they had physically died. What are your thoughts?
The answer to that question is, I don't think we really know. And you might say, well, okay, there are three statements, I believe, in Kings. Malachi, if you will, is now two books, was one. The difficulty with the book of Kings is that you can't really apply the prophetic test to it. Because what does Yahweh say about a prophet? It's an individual statement. It's not, he doesn't say, look at a book and determine whether or not things in that book are all consistent, things in that book are accurate, prophetically past, present, and future. No, he talks about an individual who claims to be a prophet, who makes statements that then God gives us the criterion to determine whether or not that is accurate. That situation does not exist within the book of Kings up to a point. There are places, both in Chronicles and Kings, which are histories, that's what they're written for, whereby there are individuals who make prophetic statements. Dode is a great example of them. Solomon is another example. So there are recordings, and this is also true in the book of Shamuel, who was both a judge and a prophet. But there are statements where individuals who have proven they have prophetic credentials are speaking, and therefore you can validate those claims. But if it's just a narrative, in fact, I think the last narrative on a resurrection, I don't think it's true. It's just a narrative. We don't know who brought us the narrative, but the narrative is Elisha was buried. There was some fanfare and a band playing nearby, and a dead body was thrown on top of his, which is a very odd circumstance. Because they just didn't throw bodies in the ground. And since, I mean, that was not the Jewish way of burying somebody, is not to throw a body in the ground. And dead people don't typically fall inside of the grave of someone anyway, but they say that the moment this person touched their bones, he jumped back up and was alive. I think that's in 2 Malachim, 13th chapter. I don't think it's true.
Yep.
There's no rhyme nor reason for it. We don't know the name of the individual. The individual doesn't go on to do anything. We don't know why the individual was dead, how long the individual was dead, why he was there. We don't know anything. And so it comes across as, all right, there is no book for Elsha, so we should, you know, burnish his resume. I personally, I don't think it's true. Can I prove that it's not true? No, but you sure as heck can't prove to me that it is. It doesn't make any sense. Now, there are another two. One is by Elia, who obviously is a prophet. And
right.
Elia is staying in a woman's home, and her son dies. And Elia is attributed a statement that I don't think he would make. The statement that's attributed to him is, you know, God, here I am in this woman's home. Why did you bring this this torment on her by killing her son? That's paraphrase. And that's just something Elia's not going to say. We live, we die, all of us. I mean, there, Elia was an example, never died, but you know, that's just the way it is. We have our ailments. And so, Elia's not going to blame Yahweh for this woman's son becoming ill and possibly dying. And we don't know if he was even dead. I mean, we're dealing
right.
in a period of time where they did not have the equipment that we
exactly.
have that can measure brain waves and heart rhythms and all that sort of thing. And so a person
that
could be in a coma.
That was my thoughts as well.
Yeah, and they don't even know it. But anyway, Elia says some magic words and hangs in there, and lo and behold, the person lives. But again, we don't have a moral of the story.
No.
Do you
know the story of the floating axe head? Do you know that story about the floating axe head with Elisha, and it's turned
mm-hmm.
into like this metal head floated down the river?
Yep,
you know, I was
yep.
looking at that one. No context
yeah.
to the story. I went ahead and
right.
translated it, and the moral
yep.
of the story is he fished the axe head out of from under the water with a stick.
Yeah.
Nothing illustrious.
Nothing.
It was just...
right. And so I read stuff
no
like
miracle.
That, and I say it's a historic book. It has yeah. inaccuracies in it because
mm-hmm.
no history is perfect. We're all flawed. It had many authors over a long period of time, and
right.
there are things in it that are likely true and that are worthwhile and that have merit. There's other things that are just interesting because they're histories.
Right.
And there's other things which I think are untrue and actually work against us. In these three cases, there's something going on that is different than what we're told, and the author didn't understand it. And so do I think Yahweh could make that happen? Yes. But if he's going to make that happen, it's going to be for a reason, and the reason's going to matter, and he's going to tell us the reason.
Right, exactly.
Okay, long answer to a short question, but that's my my answer to it. And by the way, you know, just because those are my conclusions, I think I've made it pretty clear that I've studied the text like others have. And when I read things like this, I try to apply Yahweh's test. And if I cannot apply Yahweh's test, then I use a reasonableness test.
Mm-hmm.
And so based upon a reasonable test, I'm saying I don't think it's true. And if there's any one of the three that is true, it would be the one with Elia. And the only reason that the Elia one might have some merit is that Elia does not have a book of his own. Yeah, was not revealing great swaths of prophetic insights to him. He's dealing with the Israel of its day and serving as Israel's conscience, essentially as Israel's conscience of the day. And so to have someone who witnesses him do something that is positive in their life, for bringing an individual back from the pretense of death, would enhance his credibility, and his credibility was important because he was the conscience at the
right.
time of Israel. So I would say, yeah, that could well have been true because of the role that he was playing. All right, okay. Got another one?
Yeah, so this one is interesting because it's been brought up several times by several covenant family, including longstanding family. So they want to know that if a person celebrates Pesach, you've said that continue with matzah or the rest of the invitations, they could be subject to eternal separation from Yahweh. Therefore, it'd be better not to enter into the door at all. So they want to know if you would elaborate on this a little. And
yeah.
And people want to know where
the key thing there is could be. Those who celebrate Pesach correctly and do not celebrate matzah are not automatically destined to an eternity in Sheol, but that is the basic scenario. It's why it is so hellacious. And this is a scenario that is practiced in both Judaism and Christianity for different reasons, but it's the exact same scenario. As a matter of fact, I found where Jews got the scenario that matzah was nothing but an ingredient and was no longer a chag, no longer a mikra. It was nothing but an ingredient, and it was Pesach that was 7 days, not matzah that was 7 days, because in Yahweh's presentation in the Torah, chag matzah is the single most important event of the year for humankind. For Yahweh, Yom Kippurim is the single most important day of all time. But for us each year, matzah is clearly the most important of the Moed Mikra. And it is given every possible accolade. If God's got a term that says this is important, this is special, this is the essence of your life, he applies it to matzah. And matzah is the umbrella, chag matzah, for the first three Moed Mikra, whereby Pesach and Bikurim are part of matzah, not the other way around.
Right.
All right. So, in Ezekiel, in the 45th or the 46th chapter of Ezekiel, I'm kind of mind dumb with Ezekiel at this point. It has really gotten to be laborious for me. But the Lord of Babel specifically says that Passover is 7 days and that matzah is not a mikre. It is simply that you must eat matzah during the 7 days of Passover. So here's the problem. Passover is symbolic of eternal life. It opens the doorway to life. It is the first, even before the first stepping towards God, we have to go through the doorway to life, and then we cross the threshold of perfection. You know, Yahweh says, walk to me and become perfected. We walk through that door of Pesach, which makes us transition our souls from mortal to immortal. It is the mikra whereby the children of Yisrael who sacrificed that Passover lamb and marked the doorways of their homes with the sacrificial blood of that lamb, and then had a wonderful meal with their families that evening, celebrating their freedom with the Yahweh, the firstborn children, outside of those celebrating Pesach died. And so to live, we celebrate Pesach. That is its point. It is the doorway to life. So what happens if you go from being mortal to immortal, and yet your soul is still stained with the stench and stigma of religion and politics? Sure as heck don't go to heaven. And if your soul's immortal, it goes someplace, so where does it go?
Ceases to exist, or it's eternally stranded.
Yeah, go to Sheol. That's the reason why Pesach is part of matzah, not the other way around. Because it is on matzah that we are, our souls are de-yeasted. The fungus of yeast, which is that pervasive fungus that permeates our souls when we are either religious or political. that is removed says that we have walked away, we have distanced ourselves, we have separated ourselves from religion and politics, and then Yahweh separates our souls. He paid a ransom where he allowed his soul to go to Sheol on this day as very much like a probe so he could experience it without actually having to be there, but feel all the pain and the anguish of it. And he did that so that he could pay the price for us, so that we could be ransomed from the stigma and stench of religion and politics. And so when you become immortal and you are, have your soul perfected by matzah, then you can be adopted, Bikurim, into Yahweh's family, and then Shabuah, he can enrich and empower you in his presence and in the relationship. But if you become immortal, Pesach, but your soul is not cleansed, matzah, it can't enter heaven, can't be adopted into God's family. And there are only two eternal destinations for souls, Shamaim and Sheol. So if you were to celebrate Pesach correctly, which is not likely if you're going to miss matzah, and you were then to skip matzah, you'd be off to Sheol. Now, in the case of religious Jews, what they do is they make chametz, the yeast, a missing ingredient as part of the 7 days of Passover, so that they have the life-giving experience of Passover, but they have completely eliminated the ability to be perfected by God. So right. For a Jew who were to celebrate that correctly, unfortunately, it would be eternal life in Sheol. So when rabbis did that, when they bought into Ezekiel's plan, can't give Ezekiel any credit, it's the Lord of Babel who is speaking here, that's Satan, making Passover the 7 days and matzah just an ingredient, then the fate of those souls who buy into that is the same as Satan's himself. Satan will suffer an eternity from Yahweh, and the only place to do that is in Sheol. It's the ultimate timeout. So that's the reason you do not ever want to celebrate Pesach without matzah or without making Pesach part of matzah, so that you get the full experience. You become immortal, your soul is perfected, and you are adopted into Yahweh's covenant family. It is the reason why of the 7 days of matzah that we begin to consume unyeasted bread on the first, which is Pesach.
That makes sense.
We use them as a collective whole. So I hope that answers the question.
Okay. All right. Next question is by Sharni, and she said she loves you, by the way, and thanks you for your amazing podcast and amazing website, and I have to agree, everything is amazing. The website is just fabulous. So she asks, where is the story of Satan taught, and what is the true story?
Okay, first of all, I think the website is amazing now. I think our social media outreach is amazing now, and I do think that the repositioning of all the books is amazing. And it is because of a team effort. Are responsible for the social media outreach. You do it, of course, with Leah, my wife, and Jackie and others. Jackie, who has now discovered that she is indeed Jewish, wonderful news. She is our publisher and is the glue that really keeps a lot of the family together. David, who is really the unsung hero of all of this. He has created the website and is responsible for updating it and really making it so useful as a tool for everyone. So this is a group project that we have all contributed to. Okay, mm-hmm. So where is the story of Satan taught, and is it a true story? It's interesting that Satan as a title, and it's Hasatan. It means the adversary. Satan isn't a name, it's a title. And it's a title that Hasatan, the adversary, actually hates. He is not named by title or by name in in his first encounter, where he plays a very important role, and that would be in Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. He is referred to as a serpent, which is a term that Yahweh likes to use regarding him, because snakes are toxic. They paralyze a person. They can kill a person. They're serpentine, so they move on the ground in a non-straightforward way. They're lurking where you do not see them. They live in holes in the ground and in the darkness. They are frightening to us. And so there's lots of aspects of a snake that fit the adversary. So he is referred to as a snake, and so he's identified as such in the story in the garden. And his technique there is simply to misappropriate Yahweh's testimony and misconstrue it, such that Chawa believes him. Now, there's some interesting aspects to that first story, which is that the conversation just begins. We're not told where he comes from. We're not told what he looked like, where he was, why he was there, who let him in. We aren't told any, and it's apparent that Chawa knows him. Jeez, and we don't hear a, who are you anyway? She knows him. He's been there for a while. And he has some working knowledge of what God has said. He has some working knowledge of Chawa's insecurities and her longings. So he's observed her. He has listened to Yahweh, and he misappropriates and twists something that Yahweh said to play off of something that we later learn he wants the most. Right. What he offered Chawa is to be like God. That's the very thing that drives the adversary. He wants to be perceived as God. That was the ploy that he promoted in the garden. So that's how you begin to know about his story. All right, that most prolific presentation of who Satan is, where he will emerge, how he will act, what he is trying to achieve, even his name, is told in Yeshayah, Isaiah 14. We cover it in great detail in the in that series called Observations. Observations begins with a proverb written by Dode, a Mashal, and we begin to see this play of good and evil, and it leads us to wonder exactly how Babylon, which Yahweh uses as the exemplar of all things wrong, how it plays into this adversarial role and how it works in the terms of choices that we get to make. And so in Yeshayah 14, the entire chapter is about an individual whose name is Hillel ben Shakar. And Hillel speaks of arrogance primarily, of a desire to see oneself as greater than they really are, or to be perceived as greater than they are, been some of the Shakar, which is sun. So this is an luminous source that has an ego problem, Hillel ben Shakar. And what we're told is that he has an influence and will rise from a power base of Babylon. Babel means to confuse. It means to corrupt. It means to intermix and to commingle. Just like the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, this is exactly that technique. We're going to commingle. We're going to intermix, synonymous with the very name of Babel, Babylon, to confuse by mixing things together. No lie prevails if it is 100% false. lies prevail by mixing truth and lies together such that they seem credible. And so it's out of this environment. So what do we find in Babel? What we find in Babel is the first place where religion becomes institutionalized, where we have an institutionalized history of religion. It begins actually in Sumer, which becomes part of first Babylon. And then there's a Neo-Babylon that comes later. And we have the first documentation of the integration of religion and politics and governments together and the institutionalizing within the state of religion, very much like you see in Israel. Israel had a letter of agreement as opposed to a constitution, and that letter of agreement gave sweeping powers and authority to the rabbis, because there is this confusion in Judaism that a Jew is defined by their religion, that Judaism and being Jewish are coterminous concepts when they're not. One is an ethnicity, and the other is a religion. God loves one and hates the other. So in Babylon, these things coalesced. And what we're told in that story, and it's the most comprehensive story of HaSatan, is that his ambition is to become greater than God, to be perceived as Yahweh, and rising over the Almighty so that humankind would worship him as if he were God. Very much like the thought process, and this is woven through the same story in Yeshayah, which is this, that there's this disdain for humankind. HaSatan, the adversary, Hillel ben Shakar, is, we get a lot of insights regarding him in the book of Ezekiel. The book of Ezekiel is not only Satan's autobiography, it is his game plan. And what we see is this utter disdain for humankind. And I think that's what happened in the garden. I think it is likely that Hillel ben Shakar was one of the cherubim on the walls. That's how Chawa knew him. And that he, as this creature that had existed long before Chawa existed, who was eternal and therefore and was energy-based, therefore infinitely more powerful and dynamic, could not understand why Yahweh found Adam and Chawa so alluring and why he spent all this time with them. And it's basically the story that you read in the book of Job, which I do not think is an inspired book, but it's the same overall theme as Job, where Satan is essentially taunting God and saying, you know, these people are nothing. They pretend to like you only because, you know, of the things that you've given them. If you were to pull those things away from them, they would you would see that they're worthless. And that is essentially what HaSatan is trying to do with humankind. He's trying to prove to God we are worthless. His ultimate battle is that Yahweh has stated over and again that he's going to return with Dod on Kippurim in year 6,000 Yah. 6,000 Yah is 2033. Mamamadi's timeline is hopelessly errant. It is 2033 is year 6,000 Yah. Kippurim is the day that he is returning. It is the day of reconciliations. And HaSatan knows that if Yehudim and Israelites don't listen to Yahweh and continue this attitude against God, where the Haredim won't even mention his name. There is no religious Jew that will even say Yahweh's name. They don't know him, don't like him, won't even pronounce his name. And they have their own religious festivals and their own religious deeds, and they have their own Torah, which is called the Talmud. Right. And if they continue that way, and then you've got a huge percentage that are progressives that couldn't think their way out of a wet paper bag, that are just hopelessly mental cases, lack of mental cases. By the way, Satan's has a replacement for the Mikre. It is All Fool's Day. He actually has a day that is strictly for nincompoops. So congratulations, progressives. You will have a day to celebrate your relationship with Satan when he becomes manifest in Jerusalem. So he knows Hasatan cannot travel in time. He has significant limitations put on him, because if he could go back in time, he would really screw things up. And I don't think anyone is going to be able to interact and change anything in history, even if we are able to go back and experience history. It's a paradox. We can't change anything, because if we were to change something that caused us not to exist, we couldn't even be there, which means you couldn't be there to change it if you changed it, right? Because you wouldn't be there. So it's a paradox that enables you to perhaps witness, but you can't change anything. He is similarly restricted. But he can read. And Yahweh has done a beautiful job of explaining what he's going to do and what he's going to do it. So he knows a lot of what's going to come, and he realizes Yahweh is going to come on this day. And if he can render it such that there's no one to show up, that we don't prevail at all, we are just complete failures. And even the many, many Yehudim and Yisraelites and Goyim, all who have chosen to be part of Yahweh's covenant and anticipating his return, looking forward to his return, if they were all just to go the way of the dodo bird and say, well, we don't want to do this anymore, and you'd have no one that listens to these, reads the 30 volumes we've written on Yada Yah and these tens of thousands of audio programs, and not a single person is there, then there'd be no reason for Yahweh to return.
Right.
There'd be no day of reconciliation because there's no one there to reconcile. That is what Satan is going for. He has to have a clean sweep. He is going to win the majority vote. Parliamentary system, he doesn't care if your party is religious or liberal. He's going to win by a landslide the popular vote. God's not playing that game. He's never striven to be popular. He wants to be set apart and different and special. And I can assure everyone listening that we are going to prevail. There is going to be enough Yisraelites and Yehudim looking forward to Yahweh's name, embracing his name on Yom Kippurim, for Yahweh to be thrilled. And so he is returning, and he's going to be pleased with the results. But that is Satan's entire game, is to thwart that. And so throughout the book of Ezekiel, so I'm really glad we took the time to write it. If you read it, you will learn Satan's view of humankind and of time and of Yahweh and of him pretending to be God from the devil's own perspective. It's his autobiography and his playbook. And so that's where you learn the most about him. All right.
Right.
I think that pretty took care of that story. What, do we have another one?
Sure. This is from a YouTube comment. He writes, I know people who read Yada's work and then took a DNA test and found out they were actually of Jewish descent. What DNA test do you use?
I used the second most popular, 23andMe. Ancestry and 23andMe are the dominant players in this. If you are interested in your family tree and you want to know who was your great-grandfather and great-grandmother and great-great and great-great-great, and in family trees, if that's your thing, then you want to do Ancestry. If you want to know in a very user-friendly way everything about the history of the ethnicity of the people from which you were born, where they lived, when they lived, and what percentage you are, in a very quick, efficient way, 23andMe, I think, is the best choice. They're both highly reliable. They're both going to give you accurate information. Ancestry has a few more, a larger database to draw from. I think 23andMe's process that they use is a little more forthright and clear, But both of those two are just fine. There are four or five others that are smaller, but those are the two largest players, and it really depends on what it is that you're looking for. Leia just handed me a note and says, Leia recommends CGI genetics, deep Jewish ancestry. And I know that she used CGI genetics, and it does focus on trying to give you lots of information on Jewish roots. I'm going to tell you that either the two I mentioned are going to be able to tell you if you're Sephardic, Ashkenazi, and what percentage Jewish you are. She likes the approach of these, so there's a third choice for you.
I'm with Leia on that. I think I've used the other two, and I've used the third, and some of them are more geared towards modern population, whereas the one Leia is recommending will give you a little more into your deep history.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's CGI genetics. CGI genetics is the deep history. Otherwise, it's ancestry.com or 23andMe.
Okay. Oh, thank you. All right. The next one is, how do you tell by the moon phase whether or not it really is a new moon when the sliver is not yet visible for telling matzah or Pesach?
Okay. The answer is that we are not given that information. There's a lot of conversation around it, but we're not specifically told. And the fact that we're not specifically told, I think, is for a reason. You can, you're free to come up with your own conclusions, but the very fact is there is not a Torah on how do you define a new moon.
And, okay.
And so here are just my thoughts on the whole thing. Today we have the ability to forecast back and forecast in the future using astronomical tools that have been developed by science. And those tools were actually available way back in the time of Dode, where there were scholars at the time that came up with ways to chart the moon phases way back in time and way forward in time. So there was the ability to do an astronomical new moon and knowing exactly when it was going to occur. The standard format, though, you would think would have been used for the most part in Israel at the time, and particularly during the Exodus as they were going across, because they would not have had any of those tools. So during the Exodus, there are none of those tools. They don't have access to anybody's scientific analysis. And so all they've got is observational. So you'd have to recognize that that's likely how they would have operated. Now, observational is not entirely precise. You can just get close. And that is that, would you say that we have begun a new month when the first light on the moon's surface appears after sunset, because after sunset, we're actually into a new day. So if the first light of the moon's surface appears after sunset as opposed to before sunset, it's really the next day, not that day, not the previous day. So you've got to think of that, because in the Hebrew textual calendar, a new day began when the sun went down, and it ended when the sun went down the next day. It's not like our cockamamie system, where in the middle of the night at 12 o'clock in the middle of the night, you end one day and begin the next. So, the choice was you either start a day at sunrise and that day ends the next sunrise, or you start the day at sunset and it ends at sunset. And so it really depends on, since it's based on the sun either way, and it's 24 hours either way, do you have it begin at sundown and end at sundown? The ending makes a lot of sense. Or do you have it begin at sunrise and end at at sunrise the following day. And Yahweh's approach has been sundown, and I think there was a lot of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that the only way to effectively mark time before automation was by the moon phases. And the moon phases are a lot easier to see at night than they are during the day, so it was a logical approach to doing things this way. So the question then becomes, what is the vantage point? Because, I live in a place where I'm essentially at sea level. And at sea level, you have the most atmosphere to look through, and and you don't have near the vantage that you might have from a tall hill. But what if you are on a short hill and you have a taller hill in the direction of the moon, so that you can't see it until a certain time? What happens if the time that you're supposed to observe it, it is hazy or cloudy and you can't see it? Do you presuppose that it's going to be there because of what you saw the previous night? When there is 0.1% of renewed light on the moon surface, you can't distinguish that with your eyes. Do you count that because it technically is a renewing moon? Or do you wait till there's at least 1% or more, which is the discernible amount? So these are questions. These are questions that Yahweh enables us to reason through to come up with a system that we think is right. The furthest you're going to be off is one day. And the fact that you could be off a day is a very good thing. And the reason it's a good thing is that the religious are very into being precise and claiming they're precise and claiming that they know, when it is much better to think. And because you can't be absolute certain every year whether it is one day versus the next because of the time of the renewed light before or after sunset and the amount of it and the obscurity of the sky, these kinds of things, you can be off by a day, and that is a very good thing because you're not going to be dogmatic. What you're going to do is opposed to saying it is this time, we mandate it. You can say, I think it's this day, but you can reason through it, and it could be the following day. Because thinking is a good thing, but the most important thing is you're going to realize it's what the day represents that we should be focusing on, not so much doing it on the right day. A great example of this is when Hezekiah was given a copy of the Torah that had been languishing in the temple in Yah's house, and read it and said, oh boy, we're in deep doo-doo. We got the 185,000 Assyrians coming to pummel us just like they pummeled the northern kingdom. We're toast. And I'm reading this, and everything it says don't do, we have done. And everything it says do, we have not done. And so, he said, I'm going to take this seriously. We're going to do exactly what it says we're supposed to do. And so he started cleaning house, getting rid of all the religious artifacts throughout Yehuda, Judea, and sent people out to destroy them. And then he realized, I've got to get the Kohen, the Lowy Kohen, the priests trained so that they know how to perform on behalf of the people. That took some time, and he finally just came to God and said, I can't get it done in time.
Yeah.
But this is important. Can we have a two-week delay? And they just do it 2 weeks late. Yeah, I said, fine. And then when they started doing it, and it was so much fun, it was so rewarding for them, he said, can we do this some more? I know the time is not right, but we're having a good time. Can we do it some more? God said, that's fine. It's not about the timing, uh-huh. is what it represents. So I do think you can use the astrological system, the scientific system. We do it in the calendar that we have provided on the site to tell you what those days, give you the information that you can actually determine the days. And we do, that's our goal. We want to provide information so you can think it through and be part of the thought process. What I've come to the conclusion is that it's the renewing light on the moon surface such that that renewing light is clearly visible prior to the sunset for that to be the first day, and that it is 1% or more to count is kind of my my reasoned conclusion, and that in terms of determining the first month of the year, it's the month, the new moon, that's closest to the vernal equinox, because the vernal equinox is the time, this change in weather pattern that is most consistent when the first ears of barley would be emerging on the grain. And so I've used that as my reference because obviously there aren't a lot of barley farmers that are checking to see if their grain is Abib and Israel that are reporting to us, nor the climate situations is the same in Israel now as it was then, nor is the the artificial watering the same as it was then, nor is even the seeds the same, nor the farming methods. So that's what we've come up with as our way of judging these times. And it seems to go really well. If you go back in time, you can use the exact same methods and determine the days that are important in history in this regard. And I know you've done that, Dee, in your timeline. Mm-hmm. So that's my answer, and I love answers where I say I can't be certain, but there's a lot to learn just in trying to understand this process and empowering you to make your own decisions. I think that is vastly more important than saying this is the answer.
Right. All right. So another question is, when we are all harvested, do you think you will also be with us?
Oh, I certainly hope so, but I don't know. I mean, my first introduction to being around occurred when I was just having a chat. I was still in Fort Lauderdale with Leah. Asher was still a puppy, my yellow lab, and I'm really fond of my Asher and our Asher, and I said, hey, yeah, is there any way, you know, that come to Rua that, you know, man's best friend can come with us? Obviously, you like dogs. You wouldn't have named them Coleb All Heart, and the response I got is, where do you think you're going? And,
yeah.
And it led directly to Figure It Out, Idiot. One of the two witnesses named, the other one is not. And how come you haven't picked up on it? Because I made it really obvious. Where do you think you're going? So I began to think through that. And then my hope is that that we all enjoy Tarua together. I think it's going to be on Tarua in 2029. And that I get a six-month originally I thought it would be a vacation, but with so much at stake, I'd love to be able to use that 6 months to prep for what's going to follow. And what a there's no better environment to prep than that one. But, you know, it's such a short period of time. We have all eternity to look forward to. It's game on with Hasatan. He's playing for a clean slate. I'm going to lose the popularity contest. I know it overwhelmingly. All I've got to do is have some very smart, open-minded, receptive Yisraelites and Yehudim ready and embracing Yahweh's return. And Yahweh's happy. I'm happy. We go on to eternity. If it's better that I stay, I stay. But my hope is that I get to move on, and the idea of being one of the two witnesses. We should just take a moment. I've said this so many times, but we know that one of the two is Elia. Elia is an interesting case because there isn't a single there's not a book of prophecy from Elia. Yahweh provided Eliyahu with very little prophetic insight. He served as the conscience of his people. And I think he's chosen because he's going to play the same role. There's no reason to be prophetic during those 3 years. Somebody's got to serve as the conscience of his people. I think he's going to serve exactly in the same role. And Yahweh is not politically correct. He still has a sense of humor. He loves sarcasm. And there's never been anyone better at it than Eliyahu. So
no
the
kidding.
Attitude, yeah, the attitude is sarcasm, and it's somebody being excessively judgmental.
Yeah.
Eliyahu has never been exposed to Christianity, to modern Judaism, to Islam, or to progressives, to communism, to any of these things. And so while Yehudim and Yisraelites are the prime audience, and he will be the most important player, there needs to be a voice that can address the others in the room.
Right.
And it's very likely that I'm going to be that other voice. It's never an honor. I mean, that's one of the things that people get screwed up on. You know, listen, being Dode, being the Messiah, being king, being Yahweh's announced son, being the Yahweh's firstborn from his from an inheritance point of view. I mean, Dode has every accolade known to man and known to God. Those are honors. Moshe was given the great honor of being the great liberator of his people and being the most extraordinary prophet. Being a witness, you're chosen for reasons that work for Yahweh, but it's not an honor. It's not a prestigious thing. It's just that Yahweh never works alone. He wants somebody that will do the job the way he wants it done, and he will fill in the gaps if you're willing and give you the ability to accomplish the mission. And he likes working with people who he doesn't have to explain the things that he hates. Like Moshe was the foremost expert at the time on the religion and politics and militarism of Mitzrayim, of Egypt. And so he had already chosen to walk away from those things, hated those things, and so that's the reason God chose him.
Right.
You know, I was once a Christian. I now hate the religion. I was once very political. I'm now anti-political. It helps to do those things. It also helps to have spent the last 22 years, and I'll have at least another 6 or 7 here, preparing. You know, it's preparation is an important criterion in all of this. So, and
absolutely.
Clearly I am very judgmental and I'm exceedingly sarcastic, and those just happen to be things that Yahweh fancies. So,
okay.
We will see what happens in this regard, but I think it's going to be an exceptional experience, and actually looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. They also write, how do you think you'll get to Israel from that point?
What's the question again?
They're asking, after we're all harvested, if you think you're going to be harvested or not, how do you think you'll end up in Israel?
Oh, that's y'all's problem.
Okay.
Not mine. That is his problem, not my problem. I have my preferences. I happen to enjoy private aircraft, and I happen to, it's a terrible thing to say, but I do. I'm a pilot. I love private aircraft. I don't like the feeling of commercial travel. I have preferences on accommodations because I need to unwind. I'm not a concrete jungle kind of a person. So I have my preferences. He's asking a lot of us during that period of time. I think he's going to accommodate our personal preferences. I hope it's a positive experience, but that's not my, I can assure you that is not my responsibility, and I'm not going to worry about it. If he wants me to ride a donkey there and the donkey can swim, we'll figure out a way to make that happen.
Let's hope for the airplanes.
Yeah.
Far more enjoyable.
Yes.
All right. So you mentioned on the radio something in Daniel where Dode describes having a few people working with him in addition to yourself and Elia. Do you know who these other four people might be and what they will be doing?
What I did is screw up. It's been known to do it. In the past, I just I spoke. I was in the midst at that point of coming to grips with Daniel. I had no idea what I was going to find. I mean, obviously, we know the priorities that are in Daniel 7, as it speaks of the evolution of the beasts from Babylon all the way to the Roman Catholic Church. Obviously, we know the great prophecies that are in Daniel 9. People don't know that they speak almost exclusively of Dode, as opposed to the one that everyone is confused about. In fact, I even wanted to see if I could find it, and I couldn't even find it today. But there was a reference in there that seemed to suggest that Dode was going to be accompanied by some individuals as he came back. And, you know, he has big responsibilities. He's king of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh never works alone. He's going to work through this man in that role. And clearly, Dode's going to have staff. I had thought that might have been a reference to it, but it was one of those things where when I'm dealing with material that's as convoluted as is Daniel and Ezekiel, what you typically do is you translate large swaths and then you kind of go back and do your commentary as opposed to just doing the commentary with each statement. Because it's one thing to know Yahweh and to be able to translate things that his prophets reveal, and because he's always consistent, it's always an enlightening experience, you can just say, this is what this means and this is why. When you're dealing with things like Daniel, who was a dunderhead, and Ezekiel, who is essentially speaking for Satan, you do need to take a step back from time to time and say, all right, this is the ploy that is being used at this point. And I think it was one of the things that I had looked at and was in the midst of translating and spoke of my enthusiasm for material. And as I went back into it the following day, I realized probably a different interpretation of this. And for anybody that wants to read that book, it's been published and is available both at Amazon and also on the website. But it's the first of the three volumes on Babel that sits off towards the right side of the bookshelf before the books on Questioning Paul. But it's volume one on Babel. Volume two and three are also posted. All of two is done. That's the first half of Ezekiel. Volume three is the one that I'm still laboring on. I'm down to my last chapter and a half on it. But David, in fact, have been posting it in advance. But anyway, I'm going to have to pull. I was a dunderhead and spoke out of enthusiasm as opposed to knowledge. And on further investigation, that's not what that particular passage was speaking about. The thing that was really interesting, though, there is an interesting aspect of this. Daniel clearly is not a prophet. Daniel was a religious and political nincompoop. The whole first six chapters of the book of Daniel are indicative of the birth of Judaism and Christianity, and God hates both. So it's really a nasty story. And as you get into the rest of the book, when Daniel speaks, everything he says is wrong. He can't get current history right. If you can't even get current history right, you clearly are not a prophet. But he is visited by two individuals who clearly are prophets and one who is a witness to the prophets. And so it's there's three individuals that visit with him that know what they're talking about. Two are prophets. They when he is speaking of Gabriel is based on Gabor. The Gabor of God is Dode. It is exceedingly clear that Yahweh uses Gabor more pertaining to Dode than anyone else. And so the Gabriel, the Gabor El of Yod is Dode. And he's the one that's actually speaking of himself in the ninth chapter that Christians have misconstrued to think that there'll be an arrival of the Christ. And the one making the connections between Epiphanes, the Sadducee Greek Macedonian ruler that was so horrible to the Jews during the Maccabean period, and serving as the model for the Torahless one that will follow, I think that is Elia that is has been brought into duty. Neither of them do hoots of Daniel. They, in fact, Dode, as Gabriel says, you know, I'm here and I want to tell you, we think you're an absolute dunderhead. The story needs to be told. We're going to tell the story here in the midst of Babylon so that you know what's going to happen, but we're not doing it because of you. We're doing it in spite of you. Is the story, and since there are two witnesses at the end, and we know one is Elia, we can figure out who Michael is by association. But I do think that's the interesting part: is that you have a prophet and a witness to the prophets that are speaking to him, and what they say is valid, and it proved to be profoundly accurate. In the midst of a book that most of what is written is and said by Daniel himself is untrue. Okay. It's also interesting that in this regard, since the book of Daniel and Ezekiel are kind of bookends, they're both things that were revealed in Babel in the heart of the beast, that the latter chapters of the book of Ezekiel, starting around 44, 45, that range, there's the introduction of a Nasi, and the Nasi is translated as a prince. He's an elevated individual. Satan has his variation of Dode. And I think the Nasi is the human incarnation of Satan. And you know, we read about this individual as Gabriel, who's Dode, tells us about him in the ninth chapter of Daniel. We read about him again in Ezekiel. And I think it is this Torahless one that becomes the incarnation, if you will, of Satan during the final showdown in Israel. So I think there's a combination between those two things that fits together.
Interesting. That's really interesting. All right.
Next question. You ready?
Yep.
All right.
So we have the webmaster David and Jim and Frank all touched on this subject, and they want to know that
they recognize Yahweh says he will protect us, but is there
anything that we ought to do to protect our families and ourselves against economic collapse and the threat of nuclear war, or, you know, will we be taken out of here before this occurs?
Okay. First of all, number of occasions to speak behind David's back this week in the sense of how much even Yahweh is in debt to him. This is an extraordinary man that has made what we do so much better. He is such an effective contributor to Yahweh and to the covenant family and on behalf of Yahweh's mission to reach his people. So my first inclination is to say to David individually that if there was anybody on earth that Yahweh is going to make certain has the ability to do what he wants done, it's David. So I just don't see David at being as at any risk. God is very clear, particularly in Mizmor Psalm 91, telling us that those who are engaged doing his work, he will protect.
Right.
And so I sense that that will be the case with him. Now, generally, though, so beyond, since he asked the question for the program and not just for himself, the answer here is really straightforward. And it's not one that everyone's going to like, but I'm going to tell you the way it is. This is a very short period of time. Here we are in the spring of 2023. We're a month from Pesach. And Yahweh's going to return on Yom Kippurim, October 2nd in 2033. It's a little over 10 years away. And there's going to be a harvest of covenant members between now and then, and I think that it will be on Teruah in 2029. That's, six and a half years from now. So it's not, there's not a lot of time. So, and eternity follows. So the answer is trust and rely on Yahweh, accept the terms and conditions of the covenant, attend the Moed Mikre, celebrate your relationship with him, and you're golden. You're going to spend all eternity with Yahweh, being empowered and enriched and enlightened and emancipated by God, and living in his presence and exploring the universe. What in the world is another 6 to 10 years? It's nothing.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is don't worry about it. And if you're doing something that Yahweh sees as essential, then he's going to take care of you. So don't worry about that either. Now, in terms of just the baseline, what do you do to prepare? And I think we ought not be stupid. There's no reason for God to give us all this information if he doesn't want us to think it through. He wants us to be thoughtful, to think it through. What are the kinds of things that we can do? Well, of course, spend more time than you normally would becoming prepared, because when you're prepared, you can make a difference in people's lives that are going to endure for all eternity. The next thing you can do is, I don't think it makes as much sense in today's world to live in a concrete jungle. I mean, if I lived in Washington, D.C., I'd get out. If I lived in New York City, yeah, I'd get out. If I lived in London, I would move. I would move to a less congested place where you have a much better chance of surviving during a period of anarchy than you will in a city. So that's one of the things you can do. You can buy seeds for vegetables and other kinds of things in case your supermarket runs lean on those things. You can buy a freezer and have it have more protein than you would normally have. You can buy freeze-dried food and have that as well, but you can't overdo it. And I don't want to be a doomsday prepper. I'm just not.
Right.
There is nothing wrong with having a supply, a responsible supply of food and water and of other materials for your home, so long as you don't overdo it. Because if you overdo it, you become a target. And
right.
You know, I happened when I had the farm, loved to go out and shoot tin cans off logs, but I'm not a killer. I might shoot somebody that was threatening to harm my wife, but I'm not going to shoot somebody because they're hungry and want to steal some of my food. So the gun is only of marginal utility. I happen to live in an island in the middle of the Caribbean, and in a fairly even isolated part of the island. You know, I chose to get out of the big cities. I'm not in a place where anybody's going to drop a nuclear bomb or anyone close to it. It'd be a complete waste of a bomb to send one here. There's not going to be an invasion here. So, you know, choosing a place to live that's a little more isolated probably has an advantage. Having some food stashed away and water and those kinds of things for a period of time and just tools. You know, my wife and I are pretty handy. We have every gardening tool under the sun. And so we're reasonably handy in that regard. We have our own gardens. All prudent things to do, I think, in this time, and we spend a disproportionate amount of our time studying. Now, I'm sure that some are looking for investment ideas, and I'm here to tell you that there are none, because right. Currencies, which is how we buy and sell things, are completely manipulated, and they are an object of faith. The U.S. dollar has actually no dollar, no worth other than what is perceived and by faith. Gold, which has been a counter, is so manipulated by governments. It's manipulated for a specific reason, because if it was allowed to float freely, it would expose the weakness of the currency. So they do not allow that, and they will confiscate it given the opportunity. Certainly the Bitcoin kind of thing, it's being exposed all over the place as is not being a reliable form of investment. So there really is nothing that you can do that will insulate you entirely. Some would say because of the Great Reset, where loans are going to be forgiven, that you're better off having a loan on your house. But what are you going to do with the capital? Because the capital in the bank is not worth a whole lot of anything. So there really just isn't a good answer to that. And
next question, we had two Covenant family ask about Dode and Jonathan's relationship. They want to know if this unique relationship was not in a, you know, sexual manner, but just what that unique connection might have been. But I'm afraid I've – can anyone hear Craig? All right. I guess I'm by myself right now. And I think we've gone over pretty much all the questions that we can fit in for today. I don't know where Kirk is today. If anyone hears from him, tell him that we are thinking of him. And I just wanted to thank Leia for coming up with this podcast idea. It was really cool. I know there's a lot of requests from others to do some more of this, the Q&A. So, all right, guys, I'm going to end the show, and happy Shabbat.
Hello,
to everybody.
Can you hear me again?
Okay,
so we did get back in. We only have a couple of minutes left in the broadcast period, so we'll probably have some questions that we'll deal with in future shows. So I lost my train of thought as I was trying to get back in. What was the question?
We had a couple Covenant members ask about the relationship.
David and Jonathan. Dode and
oh, boy. I think we are having technical difficulties. Oh, you're back.
Okay, so you don't you can't hear me now?
I can hear you now. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, all right. All of the terminology related to their relationship suggests that it was a lot more than just butts. That's just the reality of it. Their initial relationship is spoken of in a very loving manner. So it appears that they, you know, it's true that there are men who love other men, and it's a purely platonic kinds of thing. That does not appear to be the nature of this relationship. Shaul, Saul, king, addresses Jonathan about it, he speaks of it as the relationship as being a great shame, and actually speaks of the relationship as so shameful, it's like seeing his mother naked, and uses the term naked and relates to it as this great shame, not a bad decision, but a shameful act that is as embarrassing as seeing his mother naked. It goes on, though, to describe their last visit together. And their last visit together, Dode is hiding. He sees one of Jonathan's friends leave, and he immediately comes up from behind a rock. We see him genuflect all around Jonathan, and then he lays down on the ground. And we're told the two of them began kissing, and the kissing is in the imperfect, which means it was ongoing. And the love that is, the word for love is not ahab, the standard verb for love. It's ahaba, which is love from a feminine perspective. And it's used twice in that context. And then you go on, and he's speaking of Jonathan during his eulogy, and he says that his love for Jonathan was much more. And it's the terms speak of things that are extraordinarily beyond the love of a woman. And so I think it is likely that their relationship was, they kissed. At one point, Jonathan undresses in front of him. Now it's to give him his shields and sword, bow and arrow and this sort of thing, but he takes off his robe. So I think that the language is so graphic in this regard that there would be no reason to use that kind of language unless it was true. Okay, now, some things to keep in mind here. Yahweh does not speak against homosexuality. The two statements that are attributed to homosexuality actually say that it is inappropriate for a man to take advantage of another man when he's down. And it had all to do with the way that people fought wars back then, where the victor would sodomize those that they had defeated, and it was just a horrible disgrace, and it's something Yahweh did not want to see. He does not like the idea that love between people should be forced upon another person. Dode at the very and so the same way too with Jonathan, that there's a possibility they would have been bisexual, because Dode loved the girls. I mean, he had 10 concubines and 8 wives. He went to extraordinary lengths to beyond the pale, doing some really bad things to have a relationship with Bathsheba. So he clearly loved women. So all of that is also true. The reason I'm intrigued by this is that the religious, particularly in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, make this huge deal about homosexuality, but yet you don't see homosexuality written in any one of the 10 statements that Yahya etched in stone. So it's, and the statements that God has against the act don't actually speak of homosexuality. They actually speak of taking advantage of somebody when they're down. And so to have the person that Yahweh loved the most, who he said was right, who was the ultimate exemplar, be a flawed individual who was, very, very emotional. In fact, it says that Dode wept over Jonathan, and he wept far more than one would have expected over him. And it's a emotional weeping. That Dode made a lot of mistakes in his life, and I'm not even saying this is a mistake, but he did make a lot of mistakes. But to have the person that Yahweh loved the most love both a man and love women, and love lots of women, so that he is not in a Christian or Jewish monogamous marriage, speaks volumes about how the religious are wrong about being so caught up and their view of promiscuity and sexuality. God created sexuality, and it is a wonderful thing to make love with someone you genuinely love. Is, I think, is the greatest invention of all time. And so clearly Yahweh knew what he was doing. He's not embarrassed by it. Dothan's many wives, his concubines, were not a concern to Yahweh. And this relationship is never apologized for. There's never any shame in it. Shaul shames it, but Shaul's a bad guy. So
right.
I view it as likely, and I view it as perfect in the sense that the one man that Yahweh said, he's a man after my own heart. He's the man that I view as right for him to have sort of the full palette of love, if you will, and for that to be so contrary to these wacko religions, I think is poetry in that regard. So I think it's likely true, and I think it actually teaches us a wonderful lesson that the world does not want to hear. And I would say that I guess it's fair to say, since this is questions with Iyada, that I'm a hypocrite in this regard. I have no issue and never had any issue with someone who is homosexual. Some of my best friends, I have celebrated relationships with men and women who are homosexual. It does not bother me at all. I understand why women would be bisexual. I get it. Women are beautiful. Why wouldn't a woman love a woman just like a man loves a woman? Women are beautiful. But the idea of two men making love together gives me the creeps. And I've just said that I've got no problem. In fact, I enjoy their friendships. I think that they're some of the more creative individuals, are fun to be around. I enjoy their friendships, but the act of two men doing it does give me the creeps. I'm a hypocrite in this regard, but I'm an open-minded hypocrite in the sense that I will tell you exactly my perspective on it, what I think is God's perspective on it. And so it kind of suits someone like me to tell you, this is how I think it really is. And you read the language, and I think we'd be kidding ourselves to suggest that that language was written that way for any other reason than to tell the story. And it has a moral. And the moral is that love is love. And when you're loving someone that is genuinely a good person, and Jonathan and Dode were exemplary people, and they had each other's back. They were willing to take a stand at great personal risk to do the right thing for their people and for one another. I think this is actually God saying, if your attitude is right, if your character is right, then love is a beautiful thing. And so we should be more open-minded. That's my view on it. And I understand that most people will say that would disagree with me, but those are my thoughts.
Okay. Do we have time for another question?
You were pretty quiet during most of that. That probably took you – that's probably not the answer that you expected.
Actually, it's the answer I gave myself.
Oh, okay.
I've had this conversation with several people, and I do think that it's possible, and I don't have a problem with it. I just wouldn't want to see my own mother naked, so I can kind of empathize with the yikes of that for some people.
Yes.
Not that I want to have anything in common with Saul, but the wording is pretty clear. And, I don't really have I'm kind of with you. I think women, artistically speaking, are softer. That feminine aspect is beautiful to me. Mm-hmm. Not a lesbian or anything, but I don't have a problem with that. And I think it makes for a more interesting eternity if we have not all these rules, we can be free. I would like to have my freedom. And for those that are interested in that, there's plenty of places in the universe to go that I don't have to watch.
The reason I'm glad that this question was asked is that I think it directs our attention to the things that Yahweh views as important and away from the things that religions think is important. Homosexuality is such a big deal in Judaism and in Christianity as it is in Islam. It's a huge deal. And, the Christianity, of course, is totally hypocritical because Paul was a homosexual, and Muhammad
was a
bisexual and actually hated women. So rabbis are sexual perverts. So it, yep. they're all hypocrites. But Yahweh is not the ultimate cosmic killjoy that's saying, I'm going to make something that is really explosive and sensational and wonderful, and then tell you if you do it outside of just these very tight constraints, it's going to take away all the fun. Then it's bad. He's just not that way. He never once, with all of the relationships that Dode had, the only issue he ever had was, you did your man bad by sending him into a battle where you thought he was going to get killed because you wanted his wife. That was really a lousy thing to do, and you ought not have done it. It wasn't that, what's wrong with you? One wife was good, two wives not so good, eight wives really bad, on top of having 10 concubines. So,
clear. All of Yahweh's rules about this are respect.
Yeah, Yahweh has no issue about it. Abraham, Jacob, the father of Israel, he's got four women. You ever hear Yahweh say, no, we're not going to count some of those people because, one wife. No, that's so God's view is so different. But the most important part of the story isn't just that God's not preoccupied trying to say sex is a bad thing, because it isn't a bad thing. It's a wonderful thing. Is that, and we ought to enjoy this aspect of life. Just don't do it in a perverted way. Perversion is doing a family member. Perversion is doing somebody that has no freedom, doing it with a child, doing it with an animal. These are perversions. Don't do that. But in a loving environment, it's a positive thing. But the most important is it's what these two individuals represent. They were good men. These were men of character. These were men that stood up for each other when standing up for each other was exceedingly costly.
Right.
And so they stood up for their people. They stood up for one another. They stood up for Yahweh. They were thoughtful, kind, intellectual men of character. And that's the reason that they were attracted to one another. And so we should also view those traits as being attractive.
I had a friend ask me. Well, along these lines, I had a friend, Covenant family member. She asked me if, adultery is wrong. Why? Because basically, if we're allowed to have multiple partners, and in what context is it wrong? And she mentioned Reuben going, uncovering his father's skirt, so to speak, with the concubine, his father's concubine.
Yes.
And I explained, this is an incestual act. It's the intent in his heart to hurt his family that I thought was the problem.
Yeah, it was to degrade his mother, not his mother, but his
brother's
degrade his
mother.
Father and his father's, his brother's mother. And it was it is an act of incest. God is really against incest because of what incest does to the victim of it. It is it's like pedophilia. It's a horrible thing to perpetrate because of what it does to someone. It's like rape, where the person has no choice. You're forcing yourself on them, or you're using your position in the sense of pedophilia or incest to take advantage of someone. God does not like that at all.
And in the case of Reuben, I think he did force himself. She wasn't aware.
Yes.
And then
yep.
her relationship with Jacob was over after that.
Yeah, it's really interesting that I was trying to translate a Hebrew word that suggests that the terminology that the Lord of Babel was using to describe his new digs, the Lord's lair, was as a concentration camp. And the root of Auschwitz is even used in his presentation. And he's creating a prison with gates and people being killed, crematorium. And so as I was dealing with this, and I wanted to prove that the term that he chose means prison, to confine someone. The word is actually introduced in a story that pertains to Dodd. When Dodd made a horrible decision, first to leave Jerusalem when Absalom was leading the rebellion, he should have stayed in Jerusalem and should just have relied on Yahweh to resolve this problem. But he did. He fled. But second problem is that he didn't take everyone in him. He had his 10 lovers. We don't know how that word in today's vernacular is a concubine. That wasn't a word that existed at the time. But he had 10 women that he had sexual relations with. They lived with him in his home. Which does not sound like a good idea to me. I'm very happily married with one woman. I cannot see how having two would be better. And 18 does not sound like a good idea to me. Nonetheless,
I don't think
Leah
would tolerate that.
No, and I'm happy with that. You know,
I don't blame her.
One's wonderful. And listen, I don't have a problem with Dodd having 18. It would not be my choice. So I don't even have the energy for it. So no. So you, and I don't mean that really emotional energy. I mean, it's mental energy.
Sure.
You just keep stimulating intellectually, causing people to feel like I have value. But he chose to leave these 10 women in his home with Absalom, knowing that Absalom would waltz into Jerusalem because he'd abandoned it. Mm-hmm. And so what did Absalom, who was just a absolute scallywag, what a horrible human being.
Yes.
What he did is he publicly defiled those women. He raped them, all 10 of them. Put up a tent in the middle of town and publicly raped them in front of the town. And so Dodd came back, and he couldn't bear it. And so he confined the 10 women. He took care of them. He said, I'm going to put you up in a nice house, but you're under house arrest. It was a house arrest. I took care of them, made certain that they had provisions. They were in a decent environment, but he never visited them again.
Right.
And it was a confinement sort of thing. I don't think that was the right call either. So I think if you're going to do what he did, it comes with responsibility. He did not honor that responsibility. I think he did honor his responsibility with Jonathan. I don't think he honored it with all of his wives and with his other lovers. But
yeah.
He's a complicated individual. He is a, and I think we ought to be very appreciative of the realization that there's very few people in God's story that are presented as men of outstanding character and intellect all of the time. Moshe is the premier example. There are none of us that can measure up to that man. He's too good, too smart, too articulate, too great a character, too much energy. He's just way, way beyond us. We can't measure up. Dodd, with all of his soaring intellect and his charm and his courage, we can actually measure up because he was highly flawed too. And so same thing is true with Abraham. Same thing is true with Jacob. These are men that were flawed. And so we can't use them as exemplars to try to model our lives off the things that were the best of them, because they're flawed and real people, as opposed to this, paradigm of perfection. So I think there's a real advantage of that. Isn't it better to be in the company of a God that knows who you are and willing to accept you as
yeah.
you are, and make the and make something wonderful through your life, as he did with Dode. Even though Dode, you know, made some bad decisions, so God's not expecting us to be perfect. I'm sure not.
Right.
But yet, Yah can use us in a mighty way, even though we are less than perfect, so long as we have other characteristics that he finds useful. And Dode had those to an extreme degree.
Right.
Well, Dee, I've had a good experience here. I know we haven't gotten through all of these. I'm happy to entertain the rest of them next week. I don't know how many more you have on the list, but we'll entertain the rest of them next week. And if somebody has a follow-on question or a new question, send them to Dee. You can post them on any one of the three social media sites, and Dee will pick them up and she'll read them during the show, and we'll have the opportunity to go over them. And if we did not get to your question, you posed it, it's just because it doesn't really matter if the question is sensational or not. If it's an opportunity for us to learn together and us to talk about Yahweh and the way that we approach him and the way that we reason, then I think it's a great experience and an opportunity. So I'm going to share my thought process more than just the conclusion. So I think an answer without the thoughts that comprise it is not worth doing, but it is worth doing, sharing how you come to a conclusion so someone can come to that same conclusion with you. It's like sitting in as part of a lively discussion as opposed to being dictated to. I don't like the role of dictating. I do like the role of teaching and engaging in the process to stimulate others to think. So that's why the answers were long. So we'll continue this next week.
Thank you.
Right.
It's lovely.
Thank
I enjoyed
you all.
It.
I hope our good friend Kirk is okay, and that we'll hear from him shortly, and that he'll be able to join us this time next week. And thank you, Dee, for hosting this and for providing these questions. Hopefully there's enough to
Thanks
do another.
Thanks,
Leah.
Everybody loved
Leah was also one of this.
Yes,
all right.
She was.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Okay.
Shabbat shalom.
Good night. May Yah bless.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.